foto. I don't think we're going to stop trying again so much again.
Okay, good morning, everyone. I asked especially to be the one to introduce Kimberly today. I've been trying to consider to submit to the conference for at least 2 years now. She finally did, and surprisingly got her paper accepted. So... I think the law is an area which has a macabre fascination for many of us, but it's something which can be quite treacherous to follow without a reliable guide. And for me, that guide has been Kimberly Weatherall, who has an ability to not only wrap her brain around some of the more obscure parts of the law, which the rest of us prefer not to touch, but an unending patience for questions. I think that's probably the best that I can do as a non-lawyer to introduce Kimberly Weatherall.
Thank you very much, Rusty. I confess, he's right, he did try to get me to submit papers for a couple of years before I finally got around to it. You know, quite frankly, it was a little bit intimidating. I sort of thought that maybe as an IP lawyer going to linux.conf.au would be kind of like walking around with a big target on your chest going, hit me, I'm one of the people who makes your life miserable. Actually, it's quite different. It's more like walking around with a big sandwich board saying, ask me difficult questions, please. good thing I'm patient. You might remember Andrew Tannenbaum saying, you know, go around to your cousin and cousin says, my computer's broken and can you please fix it? Well, I get this experience as an IP lawyer all the time, only it's a little different. You get something more like this. At which point I'm thinking something like this. And in your real worst nightmares, what happens is someone comes along who looks a bit like this. Who says this? And let's put it this way, if that man was fixing your laptop, you would probably be throwing it out. He would have installed more bugs. Because that's kind of what's happened with the Copyright Act. So what I want to do today is talk a little about what's happened over the last 3 years. If you've been following this at all, you will know that Australian copyright law has gone through a few changes. Basically, three enormous acts, the biggest of which went through in December of last year, some 200 plus pages. And all of this tracing back essentially to the US Free Trade Agreement. You may be aware of that much. You may not be aware of some of the details. And what I wanted to do was try and work through a few basic things. What happened? You know, the how and why, the background. What it actually means. Easier said than done. But what it means, what the legislation means, what it means specifically for open source. And, you know, a bit of a spoiler here, it's not a very pretty picture. And so the question I have is what next? Did I just stop that? I apologise for that. Okay. So, to start with the what happened. Some of you will know this story. Sometime back around 2002, 2003, a guy that looked a bit like this got together with a guy that looked a bit like this, and they decided to make a free trade agreement together. Yeah, boo his. You know, this sometimes happens when countries love each other very much. Unfortunately, they did create a bit of a monster, and that's what we got. 2004, around this time of year, the free trade agreement was concluded. Now, one of the largest chapters, one of the most detailed chapters in that FTA was the IP chapter, chapter 17. It has 25 chapters, but this one was quite big and quite long and very, very, very detailed. Lots of ways in which Australia had to change its law, because essentially the chapter is based on US law. It reflects US IP standards, copyright, patent, trademark standards. And what Australia then had to do was amend its law significantly to fit in with that. So in 2004, it'll go down in history as the year Australia got copyright term extension. Thanks, USA. And a number of other changes. And then, you know, for someone who's involved in copyright reform, were the 2 years of hell. Series of reviews of various aspects. Oh, one thing I forgot to mention. That US-Australia FTA chapter, the IP chapter, is the same across all of the FTAs the US is doing. I mean, we're not the only ones to have received this gift. Colombia, Dominican Republic, Chile. All of the countries that have been doing FTAs with the United States have been signing up to very similar provisions. We're one of the first to have had to implement them in full and make concessions to developing countries, gave them a few years leeway. But in 2005, 2006, we had a couple of reviews, key ones. One on fair use. Having agreed to this FTA with the United States, agreed to raise our standards in copyright, the question arose, should we have the same exceptions as the Americans did? And it started out with this quite good idea, which was we would have the same freedoms Americans would have to deal with copyright material. And that was the idea being put forward at the time. That was one review. Another review was done considering how we should implement the DMCA type provision. This is the anti-circumvention law. And I'll be getting into some of the details of that a bit later on. I'll leave that to one side for the moment. So we had a number of reviews, discussion papers seeming to come out almost every week, lots and lots and lots of lobbying, lots of meetings behind closed doors, culminating in December of last year with the Copyright Amendment Act 2006. And this is the 220-page monster. It's got about 12, 13, 14 schedules, but a couple of ones were particularly important. There were a whole bunch of new exceptions for users, and there were the anti-circumvention laws. Now, this piece of legislation that has just gone through and has recently come into effect, effectively from January of this year, is a consummately political piece of legislation. What it does is essentially try to give a little bit to lots of different interest groups, and it very much played a divide and conquer kind of technique. So, along those lines, there was a whole bunch of, look, shiny things for users. Stuff that looked good from a user perspective. And so we got a series of new exceptions to the copyright infringement. iPod use became legal. That's kind of nice, you know, 5 or 4 whatever years down the track since iPods were introduced into Australia. But that the use of those became legal. Taping television to watch later became legal. Again, kind of nice, 30 years down the track from when the technology was introduced. Parody and satire. We got the right to use copyright material for parody's sake. You would have thought we'd had that already, but again, we didn't. A number of copying preserving rights for libraries, copying rights for visually disabled, a number of other things, all designed to make the act look attractive by providing them. Look, we're giving you all these extra freedoms to deal with copyright material. Of course, there's always a sting in the tail. There's no such thing as a free lunch. Insert your own cliche here. A number of nasty pieces of this particular act. The first was more and expanded criminal law provisions. Not actually covering new kinds of conduct, but applying the criminal law in a way so that the prosecutor doesn't have to prove knowledge or intent to infringe copyright in order to prosecute you. And police got new powers to give you on-the-spot fines for copyright infringement. So fines of, I think, $1,320 can be imposed, you know, basically on the spot. You have a right to challenge that if you really want to go to court and spend the money and all of that and maybe risk actually, you know, getting much larger fines. But that's quite a new system. It's the Attorney General quite proudly announced that all of these criminal law things were leading edge. No other country has them. Yeah. And it's kind of ironic, I guess. If you think about the things that generate on-the-spot fines, the traffic offences, bad driving, you know, you might kill people, environmental pollution, you might, you know, destroy the environment, copyright infringement. Not quite the same thing. Anyway, another thing that was in it, less free copying for universities and schools, and of course, the Australian DMCA. I keep saying this, I keep promising I'll come to some of the details. I will, but not just yet. So this was the trade-off. Some stuff for copyright owners, some stuff for copyright users. Is it a good balance? That was the question that people were asking. Thinking about it from your perspective in particular, this is what Google had to say. I thought their language was quite restrained. Respectfully, Google believes that the bill fell significantly. Bad policy. Bad all round. That's what Apple said. That's what Linux Australia said. Slightly less polite than Google. Why is this the view from the tech industries in particular? Well, one problem is this. Oops. Highly qualified, specific exceptions. The rights that users got. You might recall a few moments ago I said the Attorney General started out in May 2005 saying maybe Australian users should have the same rights that American users have to make use of copyright material. And if that was so, you would think we would get something like fair use. An open-ended exception that says if you're making reasonable uses that aren't interfering with the market of the copyright owner, depending on the nature of the work and how much you're taking, that can be excused. No matter what the particular purpose happens to be, it doesn't have to be listed in the legislation. That's not been the Australian model. Traditionally, we've had very specific categories. And what happened in this legislation is we continued the very specific categories. What the government basically did was say, where does fair use apply, we'll put that into words and give very, very specific. So let me give you an example, the iPod exception. Remember I said you've got the right to make use of iPods. It's a little more complicated than that. Actually, this is what you got. You can make copies to use on your iPod if you own a copy of the sound recording, which isn't infringing and isn't downloaded from the internet, or from a digital broadcast. You make a copy for private purposes onto a device that you own. This is actually quite a lot better than the original version. If you follow this at all, you might know that their original draft had you only being able to make one copy into MP3 format, which is a slight issue if you want to have a copy on your laptop and your iPod, which is how most people use them. But this is what they came up with as a second try. Did anyone spot a problem? Yeah. No, you don't need the exception if you're downloading from an authorised source. So, no.
If you don't own the device,
you leave. Some people just want the device and sound recording, right? Move in with your partner, they've got a great CD collection.
You evil pirate, you. All right, things like that. This is what happens when you try to write these exceptions very specifically. You always, I could give you lots more examples. Each of the exceptions comes with a really detailed list of qualifications. Now, there's a couple of problems with that approach. One, try explaining this to the average person on the street. Frankly, it doesn't pass the laugh test. You laughed. Second, and more importantly, from your perspective, it makes it difficult for tech companies come along and start designing technologies that will allow uses of copyright material if they have to fit within these specific categories. The companies in the US who have tried to make new technologies that make use of copyright material have always relied on fair use by their users. You know? When our users use our technology, they are making fair use of material that they've purchased. Not having fair use and having these specific exceptions means that you can't do that. If you, I was watching this one laptop per child thing, and one of the little innovations in it is that you can press a button and share with the people immediately around you. Do you remember that? If that was someone else's copyright material and not just your own doodles, that would be an infringement in many circumstances. And if you're designing the technology that does that, you might be authorising infringement. So It's really chilling, and this is what Google and Apple and others were talking about when they said this is not the way to do it. All right. So much for the exceptions. I do want to get on to the Australian DMCA, as I keep promising to do. Now, you've probably heard of the DMCA itself, right? Digital Millennium Copyright Act, a US law from 1998, which makes it illegal to circumvent or sell or distribute devices that circumvent a technological protection measure, an access control or a copy control, which is used on copyright material. This is the sort of anti-piracy, anti-hacking law from 1998. And importantly, that applies regardless of whether there is infringement involved. Now, you can't sell a device even to someone who is using it for non-infringing purposes. You can't circumvent even if your use happens to be non-infringing. It's an expansion of copyright owners' rights, and that's made the Act very controversial right from its birth. That's US law. In Australia, I should have mentioned. You might have heard, if you haven't heard of the DMCA or you're not familiar with the details of these cases, the DCSS case, where it was held that someone who was linking to and distributing DCSS, the program which can be used to decrypt, in effect, movies which are using the content scrambling system, so Hollywood movies, was held to be liable under the DMCA. Or the VNetD case, where you had an open source program that was being used by gamers so that they could use online Blizzard's games without using Blizzard's servers. And again, that program, one of the features of Blizzard's servers was that it had an authentication system, which made sure that if you wanted to use their servers, you had to be using an authorised copy of the game. Okay? So going on to these other servers was avoiding that authentication routine. It was held that this was illegal under the DMCA. You might have heard of the cases that didn't succeed, Lexmark, where the printer company tried to use the DMCA to prevent generic printer cartridges, Skylink, similar sort of case with garage door openers. So, in essence, the DMCA is the law that means that you, if you're designing a technology that will use or access copyright works, You must get permission from the copyright owner, in effect. Because if the copyright owner encrypts material, puts an access control on it, you must have the permission of the copyright owner to decrypt, to get beyond that access control. You won't get permission unless you comply with their conditions in your technology, whatever they might be. And that means that they, copyright owners, are given a significant degree of control over these technologies, over writing software players for movies or music, etc. Okay?
How about the generic tools like bug? You can just bug it on any copyrighted material or on non-copyrighted
There are actually exceptions that cover that sort of thing. It depends on the circumstances, in essence. If you have to circumvent, to decrypt, to get past an access control, you have an issue, but there are exceptions for security, etc. Okay? What exception? Shall I? You can think you've been listening in all those phone conversations and things you've had, you know, you've learned. okay, Australia. We wrote a law back in 2000 that wasn't quite as strict as the DMCA. Right? We didn't ban circumvention.
One thing.
That was really good for you guys. People like me who can't actually hack or program used to call it, you know, like the geek exception, because you guys could circumvent, but we couldn't. You couldn't give us the tools. We had a rule that technological protection measures had to prevent or inhibit infringement in order to be protected under this law. This was aimed at confining the extent to which copyright owners could just exercise mass control over anything that was covered by copyright. And relatedly, we succeeded in having the courts take quite a narrow interpretation of these rules. You might remember Stevens and Sony case. This is the mod shipping of game consoles case, where the High Court held that the mechanisms used by Sony weren't preventing or inhibiting infringement, and therefore that the mod shipping wasn't a breach of those provisions. So We had a law which was, you know, not ideal by any stretch of the imagination, but it wasn't as strict as the DMCA. That was before. This is after. The provisions in the FTA very closely follow the DMCA law. It looks like the US legislation. And so when we implemented these obligations, we end up with a law that looks quite a lot like the US law. We get a ban on circumvention, which we didn't have before. That means the stuff that you are doing at home on your computer could, you know, in theory, get you into trouble if anyone is going to bash down the door and pursue you. More things are covered by the circumvention devices. If a device has been designed for or promoted for the purpose of circumvention, it becomes a circumvention device. Significant non-infringing use may not be enough under this rule. Less exceptions, lot less exceptions than we had before, and perhaps most importantly, more types of access controls protected. Okay? This is really the key to it all. What is it that you can't hack? What is it that you're not allowed to hack or provide devices to hack? And when I talk to most open source people, they're mostly concerned about the access controls, the things like encryption, which control access to a copyright work without actually doing things like preventing copying, etc. And there's this question of what sort of access controls will be covered. Is it anything that covers any access to a copyright work? Does it have to be actually used for copyright purposes? And we got this new definition. of the covered access controls. It has to be something used by a copyright owner in connection with the exercise of their copyright, which controls access to a work in its normal course of operation. Now, there are carve-outs, specific ones for the things that people were actually jumping up and down about, region coding, some embedded software. The key thing is this one, in connection with the exercise of copyright. This replaced the concept that we had under our old law, which is that the control must prevent or inhibit infringement. Now, again, this question, what does it mean for free and open source? I don't know. Yep, I've brought you all here under false pretenses. You can now leave. I really don't know. It is actually not clear at all. This language you won't find in the US legislation. You'll find it in treaties. So there's no actual case law that really talks about it. Our courts could go one of two ways. They could say that basically anything that's used by a copyright owner on their work is used in connection with the exercise of copyright. If you use it when you sell the work, it's in connection. That is one possible reading. There is another reading which says that a court could look at how the copyright owner is using the technology and see whether it's genuinely about copyright protection. Enter into some sort of assessment. And there is case law in the United States along those kinds of lines. They've tended to reject the Lexmark, the cases like that. But there's this spectrum of positions a court could take here. And I can't tell you now which way they'll go. They could take the view that the law is aimed at being more protective, and therefore they'll take quite a strong view of what it means, a broad view of the technology is protected. Or they could maintain the approach they took in Stevens and Sony. I don't know. I'm really sorry, I don't know. Yes?
Is there a documentation of the
Is there a documented history of legislative intent, and is that admissible in the Australian court?
Yes, it is under the Statute of Interpretation Act, and that's how we won Stevens and Sony in the first place. We showed that there was no obvious legislative intent. I'm saying we because I did work with the Australian Digital Alliance on this case. We showed that there wasn't a clear legislative intent to cover all of these devices of the Sony type. I've looked at the legislative history. I've been involved in the legislative history on this one, and this language came in at the very last minute, and the discussion is obscure. I would say that they will take a line similar to the US courts. But remember, when they take a line similar to the US courts, BNetD, DCSS, both covered. This information becomes illegal. But I mean, it's a good question. It's the right question to ask. So the position is uncertainty. Since Rusty put me on the spot at the beginning, I'm going to put him on the spot here. Rusty, a little while ago, formulated three tests that would tell us whether an anti-circumvention law would be good for open source. And it would if you could do these things. If you could create your own player that uses legitimately purchased copyright material. If it does more than approved players, can the copyright owner prevent it? If no, that's good. And is the law clear enough that small businesses feel safe providing innovative products to consumers? Where do you think we are on number three? Yeah, hiss, boo, hiss. We've definitely failed there. We may have failed on one and two. We won't know until the courts decide. So that's where we are. And I'm willing to answer questions at the end if we had a little bit of time. Just a very quick thoughts about the future. What do you do now when the picture is that bad? I've been to open source things before. I've been to Richard Stallman talks, and I can imagine some of the things you might be thinking. Here's one. We'll just work out a way around it.
New Zealand
has a bill, I know, and Canada will have one soon. We'll have to go to Antigua and Finland. And that's part of the problem, of course. You know, just no, all right? I know you're problem solvers and that's the way you like to think. I actually saw for people talk like this after a software patent talk by Richard Stallman. It's like, oh, we just go to one of those companies and we, you know, run this and that, and you know, no. Law doesn't work that way. It's not a logic problem. Looks like a fish, smells like a fish. A judge will find it's a fish even if you put a dog collar on it. Okay. Here's another thing you might be thinking. I've seen this a fair bit. How many of you get your legal news from Slashdot? Okay. Again, please don't hold your breath on this one. All right. The copyright system, the IP system does tend to evolve. Bits drop off, bits get unenforceable. It does adjust. I don't think it's going anywhere soon. I really don't. We've got a very strong set of treaties. This is another one. Let's run a test case. Let's try to find a sympathetic defendant, someone who is not an evil pirate, like Mr. Stevens was, because you can bet if copyright owners get their way, they will pick a really unsympathetic defendant, like they did in the Ramirez case. His website was all about criminal hacking. Get a good defendant, run a case, get a good interpretation. It's appealing on some level. It's better than, you know, maybe waiting for the, you know, axe to fall. Has serious risks, costs. Under the Australian legal system, you can be required to pay the other side's costs as well as your own. They don't stint on the copyright owner side, let me assure you. And you might get a bad ruling. Our federal court in December did, when someone presented an argument that if linking was infringement, then Google was in trouble, the response of the full federal court was, well, the legality of Google hasn't been tested in our courts. Without batting an eye. It kind of can depend on which judge you get. We were lucky with Stevens and Sony in many respects. It's not clear that you'll get a good ruling. You might. But it is a risky strategy. Here's another one. We'll change it. Okay. Right now, probably not. I can assure you the Attorney General is really heartily sick of copyright right now after the last couple of years. But, you know, regardless of that, look at the evidence. Really smart people, really committed people, spent a lot of time meeting, talking to politicians, you know, talking to the Attorney Generals, putting forward proposals, making submissions, appearing in Senate committees, you know, Rusty, Pia, myself, all sorts of other people spent hours on this. Days. And, you know, we got small concessions, right? The same happened in the US. They had Lawrence Lessig. They had all kinds of people, and still, you know, they haven't actually succeeded in changing these laws. It's really hard. If you look at where we got the concessions, where we actually succeeded, we got some of the criminal provisions removed. That was good because people were concerned their teenagers would be held criminally liable. We got iPods working because people wanted to use their iPods. The thing these things have in common is people care about them. Right? Consumers care, media care. It's easy to explain to the media. And, you know, that's kind of the message I want to leave you with, which is that to get the law you want, there are all kinds of things you can do to keep participating in law reform processes and all of those things, but, you know, frankly, the key to getting the laws you want is making people care. And, you know, you should be happy about this, because one way to make people care is to go forth and do cool stuff, stuff that consumers use. Now, remember what Chris Blizzard was talking about, you know, moving the needle, Jeff Waugh, when he wasn't, you know, improving the expertise score on the Wii by, you know, bashing around a newbie on the Wii, also talked about being relevant and working in the relevant areas. That's very important. Because there will be more battles. There will be a bad copyright case or a threat or something, and the more people you have who get it when that battle comes up, the better off you're going to be. Thank you for listening. If there are any questions.
Can you say that this is a problem of market share? Because people in the streets won't listen about this unless they are using Linux or
having to circumvent it.
not just about market share. I mean, you know, in part it is. But, you know, I mean, the reason the iPod wasn't legal to use when it was first created, it is legal now, and that's because it's so popular, in part. But it's not just about that. It is about, I mean, we were sitting in meetings with attorney generals and people like that who just didn't get it, didn't understand the technology, didn't see why this was important. You need the right people on side as well as, you know, the general public.
Sorry, can I ask two quick questions? First of all, does the iPod exception extend to video, or is it specifically audio in the legislation?
It's just sound recording.
And
the question of movies and things is under review over the next 2 years, essentially.
And with the circumvention laws, does it also cover publishing, I guess, the theory or... because there was some famous case in the States about that. Is that
the
United States law that just simply, say, a security search, you're talking about a flaw in an encryption method used by copyright owners is enough to get them prosecuted under the Act?
Look, chances are no, that just the sheer publication wouldn't be a problem. It's really distributing devices, producing devices for people. That could be software. If you're actually giving people copies at your talk, that could be an issue. That said, if you're a New Zealander, you should watch your bill at the moment because it's drafted much more broadly in that particular respect and could actually capture security talks and the like. Linux.conf.au may not go back to Dunedin.
How does the iPod exception apply to Creative Commons licensed music?
When you use Creative Commons licensed music, you are using it with the permission of the creator. In that case, infringement questions don't arise.
One of the problems I can see is that circumvention or anti-circumvention measures might kick in cases where the TPM actually don't work.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, one of
the malfunctioning TPM situation,
yeah,
or the obsolete TPM situation.
Yeah.
Yeah, look, that's something that certainly the government was aware of. People like me were arguing that, in fact, such TPM shouldn't be protected at all. They should be both obsolete, malfunctioning, and malicious. You know, remember the rootkit situation, should be actually not protected at all. What the government did was create an exception. So you are allowed to circumvent in those cases. You're not actually allowed to distribute a circumvention device in such cases. So, again, you guys are okay. It's the sort of the geeks will inherit the earth kind of rule. You're all right, our computers will crash. You'll be really cross too.
I noticed skimming through the New Zealand legislation, it's the fair use things like for the iPod specifically and that, there actually has the exception if your contract doesn't allow this. Is the Australian legislation, does it allow overriding? You always get those fair use bits, or can you be contracted out of them?
As the Copyright Act currently stands in Australia, most exceptions can be overridden by contract. There was a review a few years ago which said that this should be changed. That reported, I believe, sometime in 2002, 2003. The government has yet to issue a response. So it doesn't. It was raised. We certainly lost that battle in Australia, at least for the time being.
Should we be designing a system for ISPs that identifies all the teenagers who are copying music with each other, like tracks down all the file sharers, provides all their address details, and then offer that as free software to every ISP so that the Australian public can suddenly see how many people are actually breaking the law already? And indeed, we can then offer that to the police so that those people can see exactly what the implications are of the law that they're living under.
Push it far enough and it will break. Yeah, look, do you have an unlisted phone number? No, I mean, you know, I should take that seriously. Firstly, I don't think people don't realise how much of this is going on. I think people are very aware of that. I think it is really the broader implications will hit home at the time when some individual is sued in Australia. You know, like we've seen in most other countries of the world. Will that happen in Australia? The movie industry people are saying, no, never, not on our turf. Now that the laws are in effect, it will be interesting to see whether those lawsuits do start. The legal implications of starting to do that kind of thing, I would hate to explore off the cuff. There might be all kinds of different, you know, privacy, etc. implications. So I can't offer a full answer to your question. We can talk afterwards. There's my comment.
Two questions. One is about consumers' rights under the Trade Practices Act and whether this overlaps or how does that impact. And also, what's your comment on the DMCA GPL3 issue?
On the latter, I'm going to reserve comment right now, simply because I'm not sufficiently informed. I kind of got carried away with this stuff over the end of last year and simply didn't have time to follow that debate sufficiently closely to answer. On your first question, TPA, yes, there's overlap. In a number of countries, companies like Sony and EMI have been held liable for not sufficiently informing consumers, for example, that there was DRM and what the implications were. If you had a Sony rootkit type scenario in Australia, there would be consumer protection provisions that would kick in to mean that someone like Sony would be liable. And I think they would work in those situations. Does it actually control what sorts of controls copyright owners will impose? You know, how many copies they'll allow, whether it's two or three computers? No, not really. It just doesn't go to that level of detail.
It's 10:30, so we've got time for about two more questions before you have to head off to morning tea. So,
hi, I was just curious, like, how well do the people over in lawmaker and lawyer land understand free software?
Rusty? look, not that well. The level of technical knowledge was very low. One of the most depressing things ever was actually going into a meeting about the TPM laws and sitting down and looking around and realising there was not a single person there who had a technological background, could program, understood how the technology worked. You know, we were explaining how DVDs worked, quite honestly.
Hello. With regard to the consumer people, please do email them. They're dead sick of me. They need to hear from somebody else. There's a group internationally, or a movement starting to happen, that sort of started through WIPO at Geneva called Access to Knowledge. And there's libraries and teachers and science people, and they're looking at the social function of information and software, and that's sort of the flip side to the individual control. And my question is, do you see any potential for us to be able to develop a social role of information policy that we can put as the template that they need to understand what an alternative path might be?
Look, I mean, that's a really huge question. The Access to Knowledge movement covers a whole lot of different stuff. It covers an attempted draft treaty, which in my view will go nowhere because it's in WIPO, and WIPO is not going to agree to a treaty that has, you know, these exceptions will always be protected. It's just not going to happen. On the other hand, having a discussion about these issues, keeping people aware of it, Lessig gave a talk recently in Berlin at a conference around December, where he said, you know, what free software people, who are the people who understand how important some of these freedoms are, should be doing is actually talking to other kinds of creators. and making them aware, you know, that maybe some of this licensing, Creative Commons site licensing or whatever, might actually be beneficial. So there is a certain amount of that can go on. I also think there's a role for keeping informed. If you have people that you know who are in some of the other countries that are going to be implementing these provisions, you know, make sure they're aware of what we've gone through and who people are who might be useful to talk to. EFF's done some very good work in getting people together who are negotiating across all of those countries to talk about strategies and implementation strategies. So those sorts of discussions are useful. But, you know, it's the long haul. These battles aren't going to go away. They'll be going on forever.
Okay. Thank you very much. I think that's all we have time for. Thank you.